When Diplomacy Fails presents.
Hello and welcome to When Diplomacy Fails.
Hey guys, welcome to When Diplomacy Fails. Welcome to When Diplomacy Fails.
Hello and welcome to
Hello
When Diplomacy
Fails. Hello and welcome
fails.
To When Diplomacy Fails.
A project 5 years in the making.
The Franco-Prussian War.
The 7 Years' War.
Of the When Diplomacy Fails special on Napoleon.
The Crimean War.
To When Diplomacy Fails special on World War One.
The Dutch Revolt.
To the When Diplomacy Fails special on the 30 Years' War.
The July Crisis Anniversary Project.
The Swedish Deluges.
Britain goes to war.
The 1916.
To the Franco-Dutch War of 1672.
This is When Diplomacy Fails Remastered.
And we are back with part 3. Welcome to the J. David Markham interview, part 3. In this part, guys, we round off our analysis. We round off the conversation between Zach Twomley of When Diplomacy Fails and J. David Markham of numerous things, far too many things to count, but above all, where I found him from the Napoleon 101 podcast. I really did have a ball during the course of this conversation. So if you guys had a ball listening to it, make sure to let us both know what you thought through the usual channels. And a final reminder, check out Napoleon 101. It's one of the benchmarks of conversational history podcasting. And I think it's fair to say, J. David Markham says it himself, but I'm inclined to agree with him. It is the benchmark for Napoleon podcasts, full stop. So make sure you check out Napoleon 101. What's in the box this time though, Zach? And why should I round off my own experience of J. David Markham and Zach Twomley? Well, if you like alternative history, if you like J. David Markham singing the theme song for Game of Thrones, yep, that actually happens, then stick around for that. But we also ask more important questions. Who the best ally of Napoleon was, with a surprise answer. If we think that he pushed Europe too far and Europe simply wasn't ready for someone like him. Did anyone in particular betray Napoleon after getting close to him? And how exactly does J. David Markham feel about Talleyrand? If you didn't know, Talleyrand was one of the most important figures in the French state at this point, and he really is an interesting historical figure in his own right, but J. David Markham has some opinions about him, so stick around for those if nothing else. We of course round off our analysis by doing our best to kind of assess how important a figure, if we had to measure it, that Napoleon Bonaparte was for our modern world. Should there be a greater awareness of his contribution to our society in general, and what kind of legacy can Napoleon be said to have in the modern era? Let's find out as I bring you guys to the final part of the J. David Markham interview. Thanks so much for listening to us, guys, and make sure to let us both know what you thought through the usual channels. And I think even just there's a lot to be said in just, I mean, in terms of tolerance levels, the 1800s and the French Revolution, which kind of ushered it in, obviously very groundbreaking. Like, it's easy to forget that it was, in many ways, the Ancien regime still reigned in many places of Europe. And
oh, yes.
I think purely for the fact that Napoleon was smashing through that just was not acceptable. I mean, the thing that really sticks with me, look at the Austrians, time and again, no matter how many times they were defeated, it was almost as though they thought, right, we're beaten now, so give it a few months and we'll be back again. We'll see you soon, Napoleon, kind of thing. You know, like, it's like they just could not accept that Napoleon was here to stay and Napoleon was going to basically change everything as they knew it.
Okay. Well, I mean, it gets back to what I said earlier. They couldn't stand the fact that the Bourbons had been overthrown and they were absolutely determined to reestablish the Bourbon throne. If they'd have just let Napoleon be Napoleon and be stayed allies and friends and trading partners and so on, the history of Europe would be entirely different, but they were absolutely determined to bring Louis XVIII to the throne. End of discussion.
Yeah, yeah. I suppose, look, we just talked about the Austrians, who were obviously not very good allies of Napoleon, all things considered, but who do you think the best ally of Napoleon was?
Well, I mean, you could actually make an argument for the Austrians because they were at peace with Napoleon for a long period of time. They did support him. They did send soldiers in 1812 into Russia, but we all know they turned on him as eventually as well, even when they still were pretending to be his friend, you know, trying to negotiate peace treaties and so on. So I would say, other than maybe a few of the smaller German states in the Confederation of the Rhine that were pretty loyal, but they were, you know, generally speaking, did not have a lot of consequence in militarily and,
sure,
and economically and so on. But my surprise answer, can you guess my surprise answer? And all you folks at home listening, can you guess? Hit the pause button and see if you can guess my surprise answer.
We'll be right back after these messages. Well, if I could throw it a lob, like a surprise one there, would it be Russia?
No, you're not even close.
Oh, damn. Okay. I was trying to go for the unexpected.
Well, this, you don't know unexpected until you hear this one, because it's not a country at all.
Oh.
It's Josephine.
Ah.
The army considered Josephine his good luck charm. She was the one who really helped him become who he was and what he was. Yes, she was unfaithful, but after they worked their way through that, they were intensely loyal to each other. She was his good luck talisman, and it was when she was forced out that things began to go south.
Mm.
So while that may not be an ally in the sense that most people would think of one, that's my vote for his best ally.
Sure. Well, actually, the question was, in a sense, and actually our follow-up question kind of pursues that. It wasn't even necessarily a country, but also a person. And I think when we talk about, because I like going from the positive to the negative or vice versa, when we talk about people who betrayed Napoleon on a kind of personal friendship level, I mean, I know how you feel about Talleyrand, so perhaps, I don't know, will we get into Talleyrand at all? Do you think he even, do you think Talleyrand made up for what he did at the Congress of Vienna? Because they often go on about him being a great diplomatist and everything else and getting a better deal for France, but does it still stick in your craw, as they say, about how he kind of flip-flopped with Napoleon?
I think Napoleon had it right when he called him shit in his silk stocking. You know, I'm sorry for the sensibilities if there's young children out there, you know, plug your ears, but no, he was terrible. I mean, go back as early as 98 when Napoleon is being sent to Egypt. It was partially Napoleon's idea, partly Fouché's idea. But the whole point of the Egyptian campaign was to essentially remove British influence by removing the rule of the Beys and letting the Turks reestablish control. This was, in theory, Turkish territory.
Sure.
You know? And Talleyrand, who was foreign minister, was supposed to inform the Sultan Selim about this. The French are coming there on your behalf.
Mm.
Oddly enough, Talleyrand seems to have forgotten to send that message. So, of course, the Turks send two armies, one by land, one by sea, and I am the opposite sword of Shabina. You know, so Napoleon had to fight two Turkish armies as a result, which he should not have had to do. But Talleyrand, and by the way, probably a lot of members of the Directory as well, you know, in their dream world, Napoleon would have succeeded in establishing French control there and been killed in the process.
Wow.
Because they saw him as a very, very ambitious general. He came back from the 96-97 campaign in Italy and was greeted by throngs in the streets and so forth and so on. It was very clear, and after what he had done with the Cisalpine Republic, etc., you know, he taking a lot of initiative that the general would not normally take. You know, a lot of the Directory and Talleyrand certainly saw him as a threat to their security, and rightfully so. You cannot mention people who betrayed Napoleon with also mentioning Fouché, you know, the chief of the secret police who was both a bane and a boon to Napoleon. He certainly provided Napoleon with needed security and information about plots against his life. I mean, but he also was duplicitous. One the best way I know to describe the two of them together, I forget the writer who wrote this, and I should have looked this up, but Talleyrand was introducing Fouché to Louis the 18th. And one writer said it was crime on the arm of vice, something very, very close to that. You know, I have a friend who really likes Talleyrand, who would say that, yes, Talleyrand, you know, was always having the interest of France in art. But for a long time there, France and Napoleon's interests were the same, and Talleyrand didn't see it that way. So those are the two people close to Napoleon who, you know, certainly betrayed him most. No question about it.
I see. Yeah, I think it'd just be funny because when I listened to Napoleon 101 as I did, and I had very little idea about the kind of domestic situation, and after hearing your rants about Talleyrand, I was horrified that I was like, this absolute villain Talleyrand, I have to tell people about how bad he was and everything else. And then of course you look it up, and there is more to the story, but I do like the idea of finding out more about the people that Napoleon relied upon, because, and then when, of course, they promptly turn on him when times get tough. But I think it makes Napoleon more human almost when you see relationships like that.
And there is one more that I really do want to mention, and that's Murat and his wife Caroline, the sister of Napoleon. You know, when they decide, and it's mostly Caroline, they decide that their interests in Naples and keeping the Austrians at bay are more important than supporting Napoleon, and they turn on him. That was a real low blow coming from within the family, as it were.
Yeah.
And then, of course, you know, Murat, who can't make up his mind. He was arguably the greatest cavalry leader of the 19th century, and was very flamboyant and so forth and so on, but he wasn't the brightest light in the Christmas tree, you know. Then he tries to attack Austria, and that works out very, very poorly, and he races to France and sends word to Napoleon that he's had a change of heart, and he wants to come back and serve the emperor. By the way, one of the mistakes, it's not as big and grand as the mistake of going into the Peninsula campaign and so on, but one of the mistakes that Napoleon made, and it could have changed history completely, is that Napoleon should have accepted that. Because if he's got Murat with him, you know, leading the cavalry instead of the impetuous Marshal Ney, Ney was way out of his league at Waterloo. The level of command, he was just not suited for that. Ney was a great cavalry commander, but not commanding the cavalry. Murat would not have made some of the bonehead moves that Ney made at Waterloo. You know, that could have changed that campaign completely, and with it, who knows? A topic for another podcast sometime.
Yes, indeed.
What would have happened if Napoleon had won the Battle of Waterloo? And would Murat have made the difference? It's hard to say. There are a lot of different things that went wrong in that battle, wrong from the standpoint of the French, of course. So I would add Murat and Caroline to the list of villains.
Sure. Oh, well, good. It's nice to have a troop of villains rather than just the one. I think it makes it more kind of interesting, and it makes a better story as well, really, doesn't it?
Talleyrand does not deserve to be all by himself and have all he does not deserve to have all of the glory of being the biggest villain. He's got to have company.
Yes, indeed he does. Yeah. Well, we mentioned there what ifs. Like, there's a lot of what ifs going on at this point.
Oh,
and
sure.
I think it's difficult in a way to kind of pin even one in particular down. But you touched briefly there on Waterloo and kind of what might have been had Napoleon won. Sure. And I know this is almost dropping it upon you in a way, but I'd often wondered exactly how much of a difference it would have made because of the fact, like, the thing that always struck me was when Napoleon came back after the 100 days, the coalition, as it were, didn't declare war in France. They declared war on the person of Napoleon.
Yes, because they made him an international outlaw.
Yes, they did. And to me, that kind of says a lot. Do you think after Waterloo, say the French had won, say it had been a decisive victory even, do you think Napoleon would have been allowed to stay?
Well, that's a good question, and I've done roundtables on this. It's there are two basic points of view on this. One, and I think most historians probably take this view, and it's completely defensible. Okay, so you rout the Prussians, and they slink back to the east, you know, after being wiped out at Ligny. Although they still have a fresh division out there in the woods, so they're, you know, they're not all tired and beaten.
Sure.
You rout the British slash other army, because he had a lot of non-British soldiers there at Waterloo, as he grumbled about, and you send them packing, maybe even not just beyond Brussels, maybe even they are packed back to Great Britain. Well, you still have the Austrians and the Russians moving forward. The two defeated armies can regroup. And when the Austrians, and especially the Russians, who of course have the furthest to go, are nearing the borders of France, a rested and reorganized Prussian army can join them, probably join just north of the Russians, and the British can come back across the channel. And now Napoleon, while he may have rallied his country somewhat, and he's had a chance to rally his troops, and good old Grouchy will finally rejoin the fold, you know, and so on with his 33,000 rather well-rested soldiers, then, you know, in spite of that, Napoleon's going to be pretty heavily outnumbered, and they're going to be fighting on French soil, and the French aren't going to be very happy about it.
Sure.
That's probably the predominant belief, but I don't think it's necessarily the case. You can make an equally compelling argument, I believe, that, okay, the scenario is the Prussians are licking their wounds, you know, quite far to the east at Namur or wherever they were heading. The British are across the channel again, licking their wounds. And there's going to be some political consequences, possibly, you know, there's a big pro-French contingent in the British government. And you know, the British government may really say, you know, let's let those damned Europeans, the continental Europeans, settle things. We'll pull our own Brexit right here and now. You know? I mean, that's a possibility. But even if that doesn't happen, it may not matter because, first of all, Napoleon can send messengers or letters or whatever to you know, the Emperor of Austria. My dear father-in-law, we were allies and friends for so long. Your grandson is the heir to my throne. Your daughter is the empress. Please, let's become friends again. And I may even, after a time, I may retire and allow your daughter to run the government as regent until your grandson is old enough to become emperor.
Uh-huh.
Okay, so that's an offer that's going to be a little tough to ignore. Or even if he just says, I'm tired of war, I will promise to stay inside the boundaries of France as they now exist. You can monitor me, and if I break out and do something wrong, you'll be fully justified to take action. But give me the chance to prove that I just want to run France, which I think at this point is all he'd really want to do. I think he'd be quite content to do that. Because remember, he was a great reformer. He was a great administrator. Now he goes to Tsar Alexander. My dear cousin, we were friends for so long. Do you remember our embrace at Tilsit? Do you remember how satisfying it was for us to be friends and to cooperate? Let's do it again. Is it really worth the lives of maybe tens of thousands of Russian and Austrian soldiers to simply help perfidious England, who only wants to make money for their business community? Why should continental Europeans die for King George?
Yeah.
Let us make our natural political, military, and trading alliance between France, Austria, and Russia. And at that point, Prussia would almost certainly capitulate and join in, because they're not going to go on their own, even if the British do show up. We will have a grand coalition, when the Confederation countries and so forth, and Belgium. So we can all get along together. My armies will stay in France. I will run France. You can run your countries, but we can have a level of cooperation and collaboration that we've never seen before. And at that point, what's Great Britain going to do? They've almost never really been willing to send a major army, all the Peninsular Campaign and then at Waterloo, that's been it. They're not going to send an army all by themselves. That didn't work out when they invaded the Netherlands, they're likely to either just sit there and be in a huff, or maybe try to engage in trade as well. No continental system at this point. No one's trying to destroy the other. No trade war. And, Great Britain, but all of Europe would have been so much better off with that scenario than with the scenario of war continuing and more people being killed and more recriminations. And who knows? Against all odds, Napoleon might have won that second round after Waterloo as well. He was a military genius. Maybe he was getting older. He didn't show his flashes of genius at Waterloo that he had, certainly not at Austerlitz and elsewhere. But that it could have come back too.
Sure, yeah. There's a lot to be said for almost taking for granted the idea that France was kind of going to be defeated. So if we take that out of the equation for a sec, and if we look at, like you said, the diplomatic options that Napoleon had, which in many ways were quite appealing and they were quite promising, mostly because of the familial ties and the relationship ties he had made, I think Napoleon could have really made a lot for himself there, especially if he had the likes of, I know, bringing him up again, but if he had the likes of Talleyrand on hand to diplomatically help him, I think that would really help things forward. But I think a lot of what it comes down to as well is Britain, really, because Britain continued on these coalitions almost despite all common sense, it seemed, at times.
Yeah, they financed a lot of them. Yeah, and now, to be fair, Napoleon's tried diplomacy. He tried diplomacy when he was in Moscow. He sent pleas for negotiations. Let's not continue this madness. I've come to Moscow. You know I'm powerful, but I still want to be your friend. And they were returned unanswered. That's one reason he stayed too long in Moscow. He kept hoping that Alexander would actually come to the negotiating table, and of course Alexander never did. When Napoleon returned for the 100 days, he sent dispatches just along the lines that I had said. They were unanswered. The Allies were having none of it. But Napoleon had not just won a major victory against two of the four major Allies. If he, in this scenario, if he slaughters them at Waterloo, dispatches each of them, off in bloodied condition, now the equation maybe has changed, because, oh my God, Napoleon is back and he still has it. He just defeated half of our combined four nation coalition, maybe we should do a little diplomacy.
Yeah.
It's hard to say.
It is hard to say. Yeah. But that's the beauty of what ifs. You can debate, you can throw it around, and you can kind of, I've always been a fan of alternative history, and I think there's a lot to be said for it, because when you do things like this, you actually find yourself exploring different avenues and realizing kind of people that could be important or options that maybe you wouldn't otherwise kind of discover if you were just looking at the A to B kind of journey that history tended to take back then. So yeah, I think...
Well, it's funny you mentioned that.
Ooh.
As it happens, I was involved in a book called History Revisited, the Great Battles. Eminent historians take on the great works of alternative history. And I was the editor of the thing. And it's actually on DVD as well. And I wrote the introduction, and I wrote a commentary on one of the alternative history things, which was Napoleon establishing an empire in the United States.
Sure.
Complete with a disastrous invasion of Canada, read Moscow, and also a disastrous invasion of Mexico, read Spain, and so on. But they have things in here about Nixon. There's two or three of Napoleonic related things. So you know, it's pretty interesting. And I also did the narration for the audio book that's out. So
if you're
into this sort of thing, it's called History Revisited. It came out 2000. The recording is 2008. The book may have been 2007. I can't quite reach the book from here with my headphones on. But it's quite worth the read or the listen. And you know, I promote it. I'm not going to get any royalties if you go out and buy the book. You know, it's great fun. And they were going to do another one, and I was going to write one of the alternative histories, and it was probably going to be on Waterloo. But then for whatever reason, they decided that they were no longer going to continue the series.
Oh, that's a pity. Well, hopefully it'll get resurrected in the future, because I think they're like, even in with the fact that alternative history can often hook people in. I was talking to a guy who does a history of Westeros podcast, and that's the,
oh my.
Yeah, and
Game of Thrones.
Yes, indeed. Yeah. And he goes into the lore of all it, and like, obviously there's so much there, but we were talking in that sense about how in many ways his podcast, because of the historical connotations and how it kind of relates to sort of modern day history or like historical pasts in many ways, like George R. R. Martin's kind of universe, if you like, has many kind of parallels to history you could see. But our whole idea was that if you are interested in...
I'm just giving you some background music from Westeros. The theme.
It's so epic.
Oh yeah. So anyway, guys, I was not trying to interrupt you. I was trying to be just quiet background music. But go on, please.
I'm sorry, I completely ruined that. That would have been so much better if I hadn't stopped all puzzled like that. Yes.
Continue what you were saying, because it's interesting.
Yeah, well, I was basically saying along the same lines as alternative history being able to hook people in, fantasy and like the history of, say, like lore in a what is essentially an imaginary world, which is what Game of Thrones is set in.
Yep.
But it can often have the effect of people look at something that is some way historical. They think, this is interesting. I like these characters that George R. R. Martin created. And then they realize that George R. R. Martin has taken lots of inspiration from, say, the War of the Roses. And they're like, well, maybe I'll like that. And then next thing you know, you've got someone hooked on English history, which is rewarding in itself. Similarly here, an average American citizen might not necessarily be all that interested in Napoleon. But then if you take it and put it like, say, what if Napoleon invaded America? And then they see this book on the shelf, it's almost like I like to compare it to, like, there was this great explosion in alternative history works at the beginning of the 20th century in Britain. All these awful, like, nightmare scenarios of people invading Britain for whatever reason. And I feel like wherever you go, they'll be very popular. So if someone sees a book depicting some kind of horrendous invasion of America, that you're going to be interested, and you'll pick it up and you'll be like, oh, Napoleon, okay. And then next thing you know, you'll want to know more about him. And then,
sure,
like, A leads to B, and there you go. I'm always looking about new ways to get people into history.
On the other hand, I have droned on now for well over 2 hours, so they have undoubtedly lost all interest in, of any kind in Napoleon.
Well, on that note, I think I feel like it's only right to kind of ask you a kind of, in many ways, a very broad and unfair question to pose to you, but something that's necessary.
One of many.
Yeah. Well, yes. Well, you may not have known what you're getting yourself into, but at least you'll know for the future.
Your questions, even your surprise questions, have been very good.
Oh, good. That's good to hear. Well, I wanted to ask you kind of how important, if you say you had to measure Napoleon's kind of impact or importance in history, in terms of like being a historical figure, even for our modern world, not necessarily for the time that he lived in, but the legacy that he kind of left behind. How would you measure that? And that's the first part of the question. But the second part is, do you think there should be a greater awareness of his contribution to our society? And I, in many ways, that's an obvious question, but I'd just like to hear your kind of slant on it anyway.
Well, the first part, and the second part's going to be very easy, but the first part, you know, I don't know how you measure as such someone's importance. It's like saying who's the greatest baseball player of all time, or who's the best ball player, you know, now, kind of thing. Well, you know, or, you know, who was the best of anything? You know, which was more important, World War I or World War II, you know, and so forth. So you can't measure exactly. I can't say Napoleon was more important than Charlemagne, for example, or Caesar, or Alexander, all of whom have, you know, extreme importance in history. But I can say he was certainly one of the most important. He also was probably the smartest. He was an absolute genius. I always, you know, tell the story of how he would dictate simultaneously to four different secretaries at once and so forth, you know, just an amazing person. But I would argue, okay, here. First of all, I think a lot of people, if they really think about it, would see him as the father of the European Union. Mm. He, other than Charlemagne and Caesar before him, and that was quite a bit before him. Charlemagne, you know, was over 1,000 years before him. We're talking the first modern effort to organize Europe as a pseudo, you know, entity. With, he wrote himself one system of weights and measurements, okay, the metric system, a unified education system, you know, one leader at the top, him, of course, but you know, I mean, it wasn't strictly a European Union kind of thing, although he had a lot of independent states that swore allegiance to him, just like, you know, they today swear allegiance to the Union itself. And to the government of the Union, to whom they send representatives. So, you know, I would say, and I think a lot of historians would agree, he was certainly a father of the European Union. He was the father of Italian unity. Mm. You know, he created Italian unity out of chaos. I remember one year I was in Milano. I went to the Museo del Risorgimento, the Museum of the Resurgence, the Risorgimento, which is the museum dedicated to the bringing together of the Italian state.
Yeah.
And the first three rooms were all about Napoleon. They were saying that they weren't talking about Caesar and stuff. They were talking about Napoleon. Napoleon is the modern beginning of Italian, you know, unity. And then they go on to all the others. But I was quite impressed with that. And I saw that elsewhere in Italy as well, that there was a real feeling that Napoleon had been a major factor in getting them unified. And, you know, there's other things. I mentioned it at some length before. I've mentioned lots of things at some length, of course, but his religious tolerance, promotion of religious tolerance,
specifically
promotion of independence for Jews. you know, this was certainly before its time, and while especially with the Jews, it took some, you know, really unfortunate turns in the 20th century. I think he helped lay the foundation, you know, that Europe should be tolerant, and that no one religion should be allowed to at least officially dominate. You know, sure, Christianity is probably always going to be the dominant religion in Western Europe, you know, at least for a number of generations. We'll see how immigration changes that, but you know, it's likely. But, you know, we're not going to have the Catholic Church as the official religion. Sure. We're not going to have any religion as the official religion, which what it was in France and what it was elsewhere. You know, the Catholic Church was the official French religion. Mm. And when there was the concordat, you know, with the Pope, one of the things the Pope asked for was to make that religion to be, you know, the Catholicism to be the main religion. And he said, no, we will recognize it as one of the religions. It will have that status, but it will not be the religion. Mm. And the Pope was not happy, but the Pope did not have a lot of choice in the matter.
No,
is
he did not.
You know, so Napoleon was definitely dealing from strength on that one. Mm. So, you know, and as should there be greater awareness? Well, duh. You know, that's why I've written these books. That's why I've been on television. That's why I taught a lot about Napoleon in my classes. I had a principal who used to joke that my two-semester world history was one semester on Napoleon and one semester on the rest of world history. That was never even remotely true. And sometimes I actually taught more about the French Revolution than I taught about Napoleon. That's why I do the conferences and do the academic journal that I produce every year, along with my editor-in-chief, Wayne Hanley, who does just a wonderful job. That's why I did the Napoleon 101 podcast, and that's why I'm here with you today, because I agree with you and others that, yeah, there needs to be a greater awareness and understanding of the true Napoleon, and podcasts like this one and Napoleon 101 are an important part of that process.
Yes, indeed, and I have to say, I really, really appreciate you coming on, and I know my listeners really appreciate hearing from you after, well, to me it's after all this time, because it's been a while since I've listened to Napoleon 101, but I hope if they haven't listened to it yet, they will go and listen to it now, because really it turned me on to conversational podcasts, so I hope it'll imbue them with knowledge too.
Well, I hope so. I invite them to do so. They can wake up now. I'm about done.
Well, I'll make sure to edit out everything that you say so that it's just nice and digestible and relatable and enjoyable. I'm just kidding.
I know.
David, thank you so much. I had a blast, actually. I had a really good time.
Well, so did I. Time flies when you're having fun, I've had great fun. You know, I look forward to hearing what we've done, and I look forward to maybe coming on your show again sometime.
I love that. Thanks a million.
No promise. Cheers.
And that is that. The end of the J. David Markham interview. It was really, really fun. Overall, I think it's the most fun I've had, and I know I say that after every single collaboration, but it's really a great example of how great collaborations can be. I can't emphasize enough how grateful I am to J. David Markham for coming on, for being so obliging, for not running away when I bothered him over and over and over again to come on the show. I mean, hey, I had to put my neck out there. If there was even a chance that I could get him on, I was willing to bother him endlessly until he did come on. But he did come on, and it was great. I really had a great time, and I hope you guys did listening to it as well. Make sure to let us both know what you thought, because we like to know what you thought. Sometimes it's fun to get together and talk about history, but it's especially fun when those that listen to it participate in the discussion as well. And who knows, I would love to have J. David Markham on in the future. I would especially love to delve more into alternative history surrounding Napoleon, since it sounds like there's a lot of mileage there, and it also sounds like J. David Markham would love to talk about it. And we, of course, would love to have him on. So this is When Diplomacy Fails. This was the J. David Markham interview, and I really hope you guys enjoyed it. It's my present to you, because When Diplomacy Fails, it's 5 years old, and we are running absolutely wild. The party, as I'm sure you've gathered, is still ongoing, so make sure to check your feeds, check your downloads, etc., and make sure you keep taking part in this wonderful party of ours.
Thanks again to J. David Markham, and thanks again to you guys for listening. This has been When Diplomacy Fails. My name is Zach, and I will see you all soon.